hppodcraft.com.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
This is our comments show for April, covering March is for Draculas, exclusively on Patreon, exclusively for you.
I have to say, we had some amazing Draculas this year.
Yeah, I know. I would say we had the best Draculas. And I'm not by nature a boastful person, but I listen to NPR's Fresh Air do Marches for Draculas.
Yeah.
Boring. LeVar Burton did an okay Marches for Draculas on his podcast. Joe Rogan's shows were actually pretty entertaining, but it turns out none of his guests were actually Draculas. This was really the best resource, I think. I do need to make a few quick points before we get into comments. When I was doing promotion for the show earlier in the year, as I told everybody, there was an accident in messaging and it resulted in a march for Draculas.
Oh, right, yeah.
People flooding the streets.
I do, yeah, I remember
that. We're talking about the subject again here today. Please don't get confused. Stay home. There is no march planned. As of now.
Yeah.
And then also, this kind of made me mad. Somebody in Australia wrote about the March of the Draculas that happened there said, "There, haha, but there was no march. I watched the news. The streets are actually empty of anybody." It didn't happen. And I feel like I shouldn't have to explain it.
I think it's quite obvious.
Yeah.
I'm good. I will explain. Draculas don't show up on film.
Thank you. It's that kind of clear perspective that I think we need most right now. So thank you, Chris. Last thing. Before we jump into this, I was so proud of my joke about there being a draclash to these marches that I really was proud of it. So I texted friend of the show, Dave Stinton.
Oh, Dave, I love Dave.
Yeah, I said, check this out. That's a pretty good joke. Waiting for my plaudits, he writes back and he just texted back, drac draft. You know, like backdraft.
Like backdraft, but drac draft.
Yeah.
It's so hard to say.
Draft. A couple seconds later, I see the little, you know, dots, and then I get the tagline, "This summer, fight vampire with vampire." So, I want to apologize. I thought I was rhyming drac with back in an appropriate way, but Dave immediately was able to show me the error of my ways. Yeah. What I should have said is that the marches inspired a big Hollywood film remake and then delivered Dave's joke. Let's talk about people typing about Good Lady Duquesne.
Kit Ainsley writes, "Chad, this is a safe place. Now please tell us, which valet hurt you?"
She knows who she is.
W.D. Tracy writes, "I'm reserving, does this mosquito have a switchblade as the name of my first solo album after my acid jazz band March is for Draculas breaks up?"
Oh, I believe in you guys. You don't have to break up. You'll get through your struggles. Jeff C. Carter writes, "Interesting show. I'd never heard that some people thought that stoked is a surfing term." See what he did there? He pretended that that was the interesting thing and not that author Bram Stoker molested theater goers. And I'll tell you, Jeff is like a boxer who uses your momentum against you. Yeah. That's the reason he keeps fighting his way onto this show. That's a very astute joke.
Steve writes, "Retrograde Orbit is great. Everyone should have one." And that is Kristina Brzezinski's graphic novel, Kristina, who read for us on Lady Duquesne. Donnie Bliss writes, "The idea of regaining youth through young blood is still around and taken quite seriously by a fringe group." Of course it is. "There are a number of companies that are running clinical trials and you can get enrolled for a steep price. See the Scientific American article." Oh my God. People are crazy.
Yeah, you know what's especially weird is I saw that comment and attached to it right under the "See this Scientific American article," there was just a video of Donnie staring into the camera and waving his hands around. Like he meant, "See this Scientific American article." Like he was trying to make me see it with his mind powers, I think. And I just, you got to send a link, man. I don't have a very fast connection here, so doing that doesn't always work.
Stuart Huntsman writes, "Marches for Draculas. My favorite time of year. I rather like this story, especially once I realized there was a hint of tongue-in-cheek to it and stopped being annoyed by Bella's general naivete. The theme of the rich preying on people, especially through young people's blood, aged alarmingly well, as the previous commenter pointed out."
Yeah. Sanjay Matthew writes, "Always happy for another Marches for Draculi," which I believe is the correct plural form. Thank you for making that clear.
Thank you, sir.
"In the time of COVID-19, the idea of people not being willing to, in Chad's words, shake the cage and take a good look at new realities is unfortunately more apt than ever." Yeah, I think the cage is shaking us right now, though, right? Shay Fargill writes, "The new Quiet and Bold is stunning. Good work, y'all." Oh. And obviously, the illustrious Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Serial did a Quiet and Bold episode. No good.
Forrest Rush writes, "New Quiet and Bold. Yeah. I wrote so many moons ago how great it'd be for you two, your significant others, and Andrew to play and record some COC scenarios, especially Delta Green. Well, you went one better. Brilliant ep, and I hope we get to hear the next one soon. Well, though it's clear you guys are doing so much these days, so patient as always. We're pretty busy.
Yeah, he says you did one better with, I think he did one way better with doing a scripted radio drama, because I don't know if anybody want to hear us play Call of Cthulhu. For some reason, playing role-playing games makes me really hungry, too. So I spent a lot of time in the game figuring out what my character's going to eat. You know, it's like a Game of Thrones book where you're like, I thought I was learning about the Tyrells. Why are we spending 3 pages on cinnamon rolls? But that's kind of how I play. So you wouldn't want to hear that. I get so hungry. I don't know why.
But you know, maybe someday. Maybe someday we'll do some live role-playing game thing. It might happen. Not saying it will.
We have talked about it. Yeah, I think maybe once we'll get around to doing that. Do something really short and crazy.
Yeah,
I want all crazy decisions. No food talk.
Craig Krawinkle writes, Chad was on fire for this episode. The surplus Dracula, the Catherine Wheel Lamborghini, and the return of the ever-present Dean. I did some pretty hearty nasal exhalations while I had this on, which we all know is the accepted barometer of comedy.
It is. J.D. Starkman writes, I love your sense of humor, Chad, but when you liken old people who can't work anymore with old people who literally prey upon young people for their blood, you fall flat on your face. Because Oof. You remind one of the infamous video of the arrogant Fabianist socialist George Bernard Shaw declaring how many people he desires to see killed because they just don't pull their weight enough. Maybe next you'll be seeking a humane way to have them all gassed to death just as he did?
Oof.
Yeah, I mean, if that idea came across, I certainly didn't mean it. I might have thought that the story was saying something like that. You know, honestly, my mother's in assisted living, and every time my phone rings, I feel pangs of mortal terror, especially right now. So I don't understand where that response comes from. Mm-hmm. But I do agree that you love my sense of humor. So, you know, we're back.
I find it very strange that JD took that as he did, because if you listen to our show, I think you come across as a very sensitive person, and I don't see where he the implication that you want old people to.
Well, but you know what though? When I was a senior in high school, I wrote we had to do like a final paper senior year, and my teacher thought that was about killing old people too. So there's just something about the way I talk and write. It just comes off, I think.
Yeah, I guess so.
Because that paper was about the Great Gatsby, so I don't even know.
Stephen Ward writes, I understand the stoked, but please elaborate on the more extreme super stoked. Chad said it twice, and somehow I feel he has firsthand knowledge. Scott Morrison says, super stoked includes butterfly kisses. Then there's the super duper stoked, which adds B. Stoker whispering sweet nothings in your ear.
See? You, Chris, kind of reacted suspiciously when I was talking about the origin of stoked. Like, maybe you didn't believe me, but here's some corroboration, because I'm not the only source. Scott knows all about this, too.
Totally knew it was true.
Rafe Ball writes, March is for Dracula is the most wonderful time of the year. It takes me back to my academic days. Whilst we'll never know for certain how much Braddon and Stoker discussed their tales, though given the publication timings and their friendship, it's likely that they did, there are certain similarities to be seen in the two vampire tales. Both vampires have likely historical figures as inspirations. Duquesne, with her use of blood to fight back the years, probably has her roots in Bathory's bathing in the blood of virgins. Mm. Did we mention that on the show?
Not on this show, but we've talked about that before.
Yeah, I know. We've talked about it in the past, so I guess it didn't seem like something we needed to bring up. But I was just thinking, man, that's pretty low-hanging fruit. Like, if you just listened to that one show, you'd be like, who are these idiots? Don't they know Elizabeth Bathory? The tensions between traditional and new ideas about society, politics, and science bubbling up at the end of the century show through with the use of blood transfusions and the appearance of the independent new woman, also put under threat by swarthy foreigners draining their blood and embodying Victorian fears about reverse colonization. And as you guys highlighted during the episode, Stafford shows off the other side of that coin, putting English primacy front and center when he says, if you ever engage another companion or take another English girl into your service, Lady Duquesne, I will make all England ring with the story of your wickedness. Yeah, you got a good chuckle out of that.
I did.
Not English, who cares? Whilst Duquesne is described in a number of ways that hint at an otherness, as she is English, you can read her as embodying the Victorian old guard, clinging to power, living off the blood of the younger generation, and needing to be cut off by the new wave coming through. As a contemporary text to Dracula, it's an interesting comparison.
Yeah, absolutely. Rafe is always on the ball. All right, now Luella Miller. Shoggoth Lord writes, you know, Luella makes me think of Lian Shi. I'm probably not saying that right.
What are the Lian Shi? if that's how you sound.
They're an Irish fairy. They take the form of a beautiful woman and go about pretending to be human to take on spouses to care for them, sort of like how a changeling live off the care of human parents. Hmm. Their partners sometimes seem inspired while under the fae's influence and are excellent at whatever art or craft they favor, but they also meet an early death. Hmm. Something about Luella's childlike yet manipulative nature seems so very much like the she to me too.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Shayna Carter writes, catnip and valerian are used in folk medicine as a soothing tea and a sleep aid, respectively. So Luella basically was roofied to keep her out of the way while Lydia tried to help Aunt Abby. So that was the reason for that.
Ah, okay.
That force.
Allison Albright writes, okay, first of all, are you trying to tell me that Andrew Lloyd Webber is not a Lovecraftian horror from beyond space and time? Because I just don't find that a credible claim. I think we've all known people like Luella in both large ways and small. She reminded me both of some really horrific people I've known who were just malignant forces in the lives of others, and of much more normal people who are similar in smaller ways. Working in libraries, we often had older volunteers who were retired and were volunteering at the library because they wanted to socialize and get out of the house and do something useful. Three or four of them did not know how to make coffee. They never learned because their wives always made coffee at home and their secretaries always made coffee at the office. And somehow they were just okay with that. It never occurred to them that they could or should learn how to make their own coffee. That always absolutely blew my mind.
It is mind-blowing, but it also, you know, my mother would get really flustered about getting gas. You know, she was scared of getting her own, of putting gas in when I was young.
Really?
Well, it was something that, at you know, she got married pretty young, and when she was growing up, that was her dad's job. And then she married my dad, and he always did it. So, like, at night, sometimes if she had some stuff to do the next day, he'd run out and put gas in the car, and that was just kind of their routine. But then when she started working as a traveling nurse, she had to do it, and she... It was really funny to her how she built it up in her mind and then how simple it really was. So it was like, a joke. But that's a good point, I think, that not being able to do something for yourself, it just reveals some uniqueness in status or geography. It's not always a negative thing, really. You know, like, it blew my mind when I went to college and I started meeting people from New York City because they didn't know how to drive.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
And the idea that you were an 18-year-old and didn't know how to drive blew my mind, because all I wanted to do when I turned 16 was get in the car and get away. But I didn't live in New York City where you can jump on the train and go to 90 million cool things.
Yeah. These guys never learned how to make coffee, so that their wives made coffee for them at home all the time. Didn't they ever think at any point in their life that maybe she would like to have somebody make coffee for her?
Yeah, well, I wonder. I don't know. I mean, it does reveal. Yes, you're right. It reveals. Look, if you just here's the test, I think. Like in my household here, you know, I do cooking and the cleaning and stuff in the kitchen, and Heather does the laundry. And so I don't really am familiar with the laundry machines here because I don't deal with them. Does that mean that I won't do laundry? No. If for some reason she stopped doing it, would I do it for myself? Absolutely. So if you're used to your wife making your coffee, but then that's suddenly not an option anymore and you still won't make it for yourself, then yeah, now you're showing that you're... kind of a jerk, right? That's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
On that topic, though, I'm just making me think, how am I ever going to get better at Dracula-based puns if Dave Stinton just keeps doing it for me? Like, that was funny and all, but now that I'm thinking about it, he's kind of like helicopter draculating. Now, see, I can't do it. Oh. Thanks, Dave.
Yeah, now he's made you second-guess yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. This is time to go back to therapy.
Can you ask Rachel what she would say if a client came in and was like, I got a really good friend. We're old friends. We're good friends. But he made this one Dracula pun. It kind of upset me. Do you have any other issues you want to discuss? No, this is what I'm here to talk about.
I can't make Dracula jokes.
I just
want to
get her therapy. I just want to get her perspective on that.
I'll have her jump in on the next episode.
Yeah, do it. Yeah, run it up the flagpole.
Sebastian Tenewo writes, I'm really glad Congressman Foghorn Leghorn is doing what we elected him for, cracking down on all those fake Lovecraft podcasts. Finally, an honest politician.
Yeah, well, that's an opinion.
Eric, Speaker in Digressions, writes, I am informed by my girlfriend, Rebecca, that Judge John Hodgman once asked listeners to research the origin of the Dracula blah, blah, blah. The results were compiled in a Halloween 2011 post on the Maximum Fun website. If you Google Dracula blah, blah and Maximum Fun, you'll find it. The theories were indeed that it comes from Lugosi saying blood, but not so much from the 30s films. Instead, Hodgman's fans, researchers, pointed to the 1952 musical comedy My Son the Vampire, a.k.a. Vampire Over London, with Lugosi, and the title song added to the film's release a decade later by Alan Sherman, which both feature blood pronounced blood. Hmm. Other possible sources or other links of this chain include comedian Gabriel Dell on The Steve Allen Show, horror host Svengoolie's Pet Theory, and a Lenny Bruce routine featuring Yiddish Dracula endorsed by Dave Scull's Monster Show History of Horror. So it looks like pop culture has added blah in a way similar to the figure of Dr. Frankenstein's minion Igor through comedy and satire.
See, now that's the kind of information that people need to be hearing right now.
Yeah.
Igor is in the movies, though. People often forget.
He's in
the third Frankenstein movie. It's Bela Lugosi.
Right.
He created that character. People often think of Dwight Frye, who played Fritz in the first two movies, and then that gets conflated with Igor. But it is a real character that Bela Lugosi created. That's also important information to get out right now. When I worked in the music library back in college, I remember I was shelving books one day, and I picked up this score for a musical called The Dracula Spectacular. And it's a real thing. I read the title, but I shelved it because I thought, man, nothing in this book is going to measure up to that title. I wasn't a Lovecraftian protagonist in that situation. I was like, I don't want this knowledge. Arthur J. Salazar writes, this episode reminded me of a TV show called What We Do in the Shadows. One episode, you meet a legit emotional vampire who just drained people by making them feel sorry for her. She has lines like, I think my dog has autism. It was played for laughs, but people like this kind of exist. They play the victim or feel the world is against them and rely on others to survive or just con you. My favorite thing about that comment is it assumes I haven't watched that movie or TV show like 90,000 times.
Yeah, I know. Of course. We both watched it. We're huge fans of the movie and the TV show.
But I will say it was a huge mistake that we didn't make that connection on the show.
Rafe Ball writes, Luella certainly seems oblivious to the harm she's doing, or at least she sees it as the natural order of things that others should be taking care of her every whim. Is she perhaps like Duquesne, a representation of a parasitic upper class sucking life out of the lower class to maintain themselves? Mind you, she also sucks the life out of the respectable doctor. Perhaps she is a parodic extreme version of the ideal of the higher social class woman of the period, disenfranchised, passive. There is to be a pretty wife and support her husband's social position. She's so empty of agency and personality that she, in turn, drains others of theirs until they drop dead. I pulled out my old copy of Our Vampire Ourselves by Nina Arbach off the shelf, and she notes that the vital fluid in Luella Miller is not blood, but work, which has a very Marxist ring to it.
It's very insightful. That book, Our Vampires Ourselves, is really good, but I've always kind of been more partial to Auerbach's follow-up, Your Frankensteins, You Deal With Them. I think that one's got a lot of good insights, too. On to this Lovecraftian anime show. Brian Johnson writes, I've watched the Evangelion series maybe 5 or 6 times in its entirety for the last 20, 25 years, and I have never heard of this ancient civilization spaceship backstory that Chris is detailing here. Is this something that was established in some other media? Was this from the rebuilds? In the dubs, maybe? The manga? Am I losing my mind at such a tender age?
As I said, I didn't rewatch Evangelion. I just went down the rabbit hole with my research, and I think that that stuff is from a video game.
Oh.
Which is one of the many different things that is officially Evangelion, but not necessarily part of. Because it's kind of the whole levels of canon thing. You know, they have this in Star Trek. They used to have it in Star Wars, that there were like levels, like there was Lucas level canon, the certain television shows, and then the novels had a level of canon, and the role-playing game was below that. Evangelion, just like that in Star Trek, has levels of canon. I went back and had to dig it up, and I'm pretty positive that all that stuff from the video game, or one of the video games, I'm not sure which one it is. But I had a limited amount of time to do my research, and so when I got onto the Evangelion wiki, where all this stuff is cited, I just took it as common knowledge. I didn't realize I was delving into a deeper layer of strata, so I apologize.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can understand why listeners would get upset, though. Because, if you even just listen to the show we've been doing here, this is all about factual, realistic, sometimes uncomfortably gritty news.
Yeah.
And so getting something even a little wrong can shake people up in terms of trust, you know? I mean, let's not forget when Walter Cronkite called it Vampire Hunter C. He was never the same again after that.
Career right down the toilet. More on this. Brian Johnson writes, exactly. 10 minutes of browsing around that and other Eva theory sites gave me a strong fanfic vibe, specifically the variety that craves a reason or explanation for everything. A demand for all things to be connected. The best thing about Evangelion was that nothing ever truly gets explained in plain terms. I distinctly remember the feeling I got when I first watched it. A feeling of great anticipation for when everything would be made clear. When it didn't, especially since I saw the TV ending before the movies had ever been out, it was shocking. But what I initially experienced as feeling cheated, I soon realized as a weird feeling and was blown away. Theories are fun, of course, but the hunger for canon in all things, whether it's an explanation as to the angel's origins or, say, half of the Star Wars content in the last 30 years leaves me bewildered at best.
Yeah, I'd agree with that sentiment. You know, we got some information wrong. I get it, because I remember that prior to doing this show, I'd read a synopsis of something that said, based on the works of H.P. Lovecraft, you know, the devil gets a copy of the Necronomicon, and two werewolves are there to help him. And I'd go, what is going on, man? You know, I would get really mad about it.
I'm not saying I was wrong. I'm just saying it was from the television show.
Yeah.
It was from a licensed video game, so it's not completely out of the question. However, it was not in the anime. It wasn't in the show. I was wrong about.
Next month, we're going to do a bonus episode on the NFL, and we're going to have everything 100% correct in that one. That's an area of our expertise, thank God. So we'll make up for it.
Let's jump into Shamblou. Ben Munn writes, haven't listened yet. I will be very disappointed if this is not somehow related to ShamWow.
I have to admit, I that didn't occur to me, and you would think it would, because it's really funny. Again, it shows the effects of Dave Stinton mothering me. Lee Russell writes, the creature in this somewhat reminds me of the M113 creature, or the salt vampire, as it's commonly known in the Star Trek the original series episode, The Man Trap.
Yep.
Although not a Medusa, it is the last of its species and uses telepathic illusions to hunt its prey for the salt it needs to survive, also using some sort of supposed hypnotic or paralyzing power to keep its prey still as it closes in. It takes the form of a former lover of Dr. McCoy's and enthralls him for much of the episode. Probably my favorite original series, Rubber Suit Monster.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. It's a pretty creepy looking thing. That's a good point.
That was a really good point. I will say, I'm going to ask some of our commenters in the future to be more careful. We'll leave it in the show this time, but just for future reference, some people might not know that's a rubber suit in that show. So,
right, we should have
guard your words, is what I'm saying.
A spoiler alert?
Spoiler alert, or just don't say it. You know, why ruin some 30-year-old's dreams?
Sure, of course. H.R. Price writes, I feel like the theme, you try and help someone, but then it's bad, can be a really strong foundation for a work of horror. You're trying to do what society always tells you is good and right and brave, but opening yourself up to con artists, sociopaths, and Draculas in the process. I think a smart horror story would go to the effort of contrasting the other extreme, a society so traumatized by this that no one helps anyone ever, and the horror of being caught in that situation. That could temper the implied lesson of you help people, you get Medusa'd. Plus, you get the bonus horror of it being a situation with no right answer. Haha, reality is terrifying. That said, I agree with the story leans more on the sexy savior trope than anything I just described. It was going for something else.
Definitely. It's a great story.
Yeah, I really like it.
Devin Trim writes, oh my God, I was randomly listening to a comments show from last year and the topic of swearing on the podcast came up, to which Chad comically says, you. And I was pleasantly taken aback. You gentlemen should swear more freely. Surely we're all adults here. Plus, some well-timed cursing can be a great way to enhance your already wonderful comedy and add a touch of human connection. Just some thoughts from a long-time listener. We keep it clean just to, you know, have a larger audience if somebody doesn't like to hear that stuff. But I also gotta say, you and I have known each other since we were teenagers when I was at the height of potty mouth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so when we start talking, I slip right back into it. So I just don't think people want those floodgates to get open because it's obscene.
No. Yeah. It's too much. And I listen to our show with the kids. The kids are around when it's on. They'll have to pay attention and stuff. So I like having a podcast where I don't have to worry about playing it in front of my children.
Yeah. We try to let you know. Not always on the show, but like in the show notes, there was swearing on the patent shows and stuff because it didn't feel right to delete that.
No.
So occasionally one of them will have that, but in general, we try to keep it family friendly. Because I don't know who's in your car with you.
Exactly.
You know, you might have abducted somebody who doesn't even like the show. The funny thing is that if you say that comment in a different way, it's a great joke. It says, you know, Chad said something and I was pleasantly taken aback. Oh, what did he say? You. Awesome. Now onto the comments show from that month.
That was called Moneybags Lackey. I don't remember why.
It was called Moneybags Lackey because somebody commented that I had said we were done with the King in Yellow, and then when suddenly we had sponsors and Ken on, you were like, no, let's do more. By the way, I mean, we didn't really have sponsors. Those were just the people on the show. Of course, we're going to say what they're up to, but actually
no money was exchanged.
As a result, I thought it was funny to pretend there was. But yes. Peter Larson writes, I tell you, it's sobering when Chad or Chris read some names with evident delight and playful additions when others just get a curt reading. I guess it means the inevitable day when I hear Larson, that pompous jerk. Not that it would be fair mind to you. You know, actually, sometimes people will email and say, hey, I joined a long time ago and I haven't heard my name yet. We do it kind of randomly.
It is random.
And we love everybody, but yeah, some names are going to be funnier than others because people don't use their real names. I mean, if your name is Dr. Fart, you know.
When they came up with Dr. Fartopoulos before they moved over to the United States and it got shortened. You know, the immigration thing. They always had Americanized totally. Everybody's names.
That's the American story.
But Peter Larson, you're a treasure. Don't ever think. We think bad of anybody. We love all of you. The fact that you're contributing and being part of our entity, the entity that is HP Podcraft, makes our lives worth living.
Yeah, I don't want to say, wow. And the only people I want it to sound curt is if your name is actually Kurt. Scott Morrison writes, do we have
Scott Morrison.
Hey, Scott, what's up? Scott Morrison writes, do we have an HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast drinking game? If not, we should start one. First rule, one drink for every mention of Manimal.
Oh, boy.
No, I don't want to be responsible for that. I don't want people to become drunks, but also I don't want anybody drinking so much that they forget Manimal. I mean, what was the point of any of this then?
And finally, the last episode of the month, The Girl with the Hungry Eyes.
Shoggoth Lord writes, I would be so on board with the retelling of this tale where the girl is an anti-hero. Yeah, I agree. I think it would be an easy adaptation. And so Somebody do it, because I don't want to work on it. I just want to see it.
Shoggoth goes on to write, Chris, when Dave is showing the snapshots to old Papa and he starts getting dizzy, she is there in the photo. A point discussed by the story and underscored by the tale's end is that she isn't a conventional vampire. She doesn't feed off blood. Hers is a more ethereal, psychic repast, devouring people's memories, their feelings, their minds. It's implied she's going through this whole nonsense with the photography because she can feed a little through her image, catching some part of the attention directed at her. Likely, this is why she doesn't pose for illustrations. The result is this simulacrum of her image, so it doesn't do anything for her. It only makes sense that it goes both ways, that she can project her will through her image.
Wow. Yeah, I think that's right on.
Yeah.
And this comment continues, and on that point, I think the reason she is this way, the way the story frames her, is she's intended as a kind of embodiment of consumerism itself and the constant yearning hunger of capitalism for more attention, more capital, more people buying into whatever product that's being peddled. She's also, in a fairly literal way, eating her so-called consumers, which reminds me of a notion I heard Noam Chomsky talk about recently. The normal way you look at advertising is that a company puts an ad in front of the public to try and sell its product to people to make money. Another way to look at it, though, is that a media outlet puts ads in front of their viewers to try and get them to buy from a specific corporation so the outlet can earn more revenue from that company. From this angle, the people seeing the ads aren't the consumers, you know. They're the product. Thank you for that insight. I want to say, on that episode, I actually went off on this very topic at length. I mean, I was talking about the Oscars. It really went off the rails, and all of that got cut. But what you say is so true, and in all seriousness, I hope people will consider this point when they watch the news, especially right now. It's very important to stay abreast of what's going on, but in the 99% of it is actually a buying cycle between media companies, politicians, and other entities. So the news has to be urgent and interesting on an hourly basis, so you're seeing the ads. You know, and the stuff that drives that news cycle has to be messed up enough to get you there hourly and drive the revenue to buy those ads. And then they need to earn the money so they can pay for those ads. This is a really sick cycle. And if it makes you feel anxious, just know you don't have to feel that way. You can absorb about a half hour of it and then just ignore it for the rest of the time, because you really are part of that advertising cycle when you're just glued to it. You know, I'm saying that as somebody who's frequently there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because when we were growing up, there was a half hour of news on each of the networks at the same time.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much it. Or the local news. Yeah, the local news as well. But now that there are these 24-hour news cycles, you know, every day, 7 days a week, it's insane. And obviously, they're all businesses.
Yeah. So, no, of course.
Yeah. So keep that in mind whenever you're watching.
Always keep that in mind. I think a good question is you say to yourself, yes, this is horrible. Yes, maybe this is outrageous. Is there something I can do about it personally right now? If there's a little action you can take, great. But if there really is anything about it you can control, then bingo, let it go. You know, get into something that you can control. Because if you keep your focus on yourself, then you're going to be able to withstand anything that's terrible happening in the world. So that's my little pitch you didn't ask for. But
made
me think of it. Yeah. Well, hey, it's the bonus episode.
So Crystal Beyer writes, greatly enjoyed this. Loved the story. Loved the reader. More of Nick, please. Appreciated your insights about the noir genre advertising, especially the take on how the girl could be presented as the hero.
Pagurus writes, I agree. HP Podcraft has a proud tradition of excellent readers. When they don't excel, the worst you could say about any of them is that he or she gave a rock solid performance. But this guy, Nick, really nailed the noir tone you referenced. It's so cool you have professional voice actors like him to read to us. I will forward these things to Nick. I do think he's great. And
I think
he
really
came
good.
Over and all that stuff was like one take. He knew exactly what to do with it. So,
Yes.
Yeah. We're very lucky that he came on the show, and hopefully we'll have him back. That's all we have for this comments episode. Been great chatting with you, Chris, and
yes.
I hope that we'll have all of y'all back. Next month, we're going to be talking Lovecraft again, so I think you're going to want to show up for that.
And with that, I'm Chris Lanke.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to
the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, exclusively on Patreon.